Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast. I'm John Bruford. I'm one of your hosts. Your other host is the effervescent, the bubbly, the sprinkles on top of your fairy cake, Fintan Costello. Hello, Fintan.
Hello, John.
Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
I've had the builders in, the landlord's renovating the kitchen, so I've had builders in the kitchen. And
isn't for a second this. I've had the builders in, the piles are terrible.
And there's construction work going on outside the window as well. And yeah, it's been a long day. It's been a long day, but that's okay.
But hang on, I thought your office was outside the house.
It is, but I've got to guard the house when the builders are here because my wife's out and about today. So I've got to make sure
they're just
not.
Have you got dodgy builders?
Well, you want to make sure they're not in the underwear drawer and stuff like that because I've got some really good boxer shorts I don't want them to
check. Yeah, no, I bet. I bet you have.
So, yeah.
Has Bonus Finder ever done any, you know, promotional boxer shorts?
No, I do have a pair of the Paddy Power Lucky Y fronts from that campaign.
Well, can I just give you a phonetic marketing tool here? Bonus Finder.
Way.
Obviously, you put the logo on the front.
It's not the worst idea I've heard today. I like it.
I've got many worse. That was the cream off the top of this particular cake.
And in Spanish, it's Bono, right? So it even gets even better in Spanish, I think.
Ooh, you could do a tie-in with you too.
Well, no, I was thinking more Bono. Anyway, I was playing with that.
So on this week's episode, Fintan, we have
we had Mr. Neiman, Mr. Tom Neiman.
We have Tom Neiman. Tom is talking about the latest developments in Chicago with the casino. There is a bit of chit chat about John Hughes and Chicago greats.
And Tom just name drops casually one of the world's greatest actors as a close friend. So,
well, he didn't say close friend, but he did say they were at school together.
But he was able to ring him up and get him to show up for events and stuff. And
yeah, that is pretty cool.
Like, you know, you don't just do that.
That is pretty. And Tommy just drops it into the conversation. He's just like,
it's because he's a successful man. You see, he doesn't need to. He already knows he's the alpha when he's talking to us, right? So he doesn't need to try and dominate us. It just happens.
I think it's fair to say when he's talking to us, he's the alpha and the beta.
True,
because you know that's A and B, and we're obviously C,
the C team.
And we know from last week's episode what C stands for, right, Fintan?
We do.
And then we were joined by Alberto Alfieri, co-founder of Jada. He's a very nice man as well, and Paul Crisp, also an excellent name. From Simplify, they were talking about their hyper-personalization tool, which they claim is not all hype, and it's not shit at all.
Wow. Well, that's a big claim.
I know.
They have to say that, though, right? Did you?
Apparently, they did. They did mention that there was contractual obligations.
Got it.
But also, 50% of that particular guest group watches Cobra Kai.
So what are we up to? Number are we up to three now?
Yeah. But also, Fintan, I have started a support group called Cobra Kai Matters.
Okay.
Because I've realized that we're a minority. And we got to get word out. Do you know what I mean?
So I'm into season four now.
Wow, you're moving very nicely along there.
Yeah. It delivers.
It really does consistently. I mean, it's a remarkably consistent show.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very good.
It's so good. And, you know, Cobra Kai Matters. I'm going to get some CKM t-shirts made, I think.
Yeah, that works. I actually saw somebody in the street today with a Cobra Kai t-shirt. And I nearly went up and talked to them. But then I realized that's just weird. Don't.
Not at all.
It is when you're as introverted as I am.
I've just had two really odd memories. I once talked to a guy at the gym, and I'm not somebody that talks to people at the gym generally. But I was just, I think I'd just finished working out and this guy was just walking into the dressing rooms, changing rooms, dressing rooms, well, both. He had a Pearl Jam tattoo, but it was a very specific font, which was used when they did the Jeremy single, so off the first album. So it was a really, he'd chosen a really old little promotional thing of theirs. And I'm walking past him and I go, nice tattoo. And I realize we're in the changing room of a gym. I'm sweaty. He's, you know, immaculate in his workout gear. And I thought, do you know what? This could be misconstrued. This is a long time ago and the world was a different place. And so I said to him, also, I realize how that sounds. So I just wanted to say, I am also a Pearl Jam fan.
I accidentally joined a gay gym once.
Oh, nice.
It was great. So first of all the women are really good looking because it was in, where was it? It was in London. And I think they were all like strippers or something. So like all the women, they just went there because they weren't being harassed by the guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the blokes in there were really friendly. So you know the way like when two people reach for the weights bench at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a little Mexican standoff as to who gets it. So it was like my first day there. I went for the weights bench and some other guy stepped in as well at the same time. And we both made eye contact. And this guy was just a monster, right? Just like the guy who lifts the biggest weights in the gym type thing. And I'm like, oh, here we go. He's going to kick off and roid rage and this will be awful. And then he was just super nice. Oh, sorry, I didn't realize, didn't see you there. Have a great workout. And everyone in the gym was super free. We moved afterwards, but I was super happy with that gym. It was great.
Yeah, it was super
friendly.
Nice.
It was a really friendly gym. I'd highly recommend it.
Well, you know, I've only got a little gym here, but I bought a weights bench, which it just seemed like a lot of work to put it together.
It's part of your workout though, isn't it?
Yeah, but that would be a long workout. But I'll get to it. I will get to it because I bought kind of the bench of my dreams. Got a separate squat stand and stuff.
Nice.
And I'm a little bit excited. And I think the bench will take about 220 kilos combined, person and weight.
Whoopah.
Which, while it's not huge, I mean it's plenty for now.
That's heavy, mate. If you're lifting that. What, you're lifting 100 kilos?
Well, it depends where, doesn't it?
Yeah,
can I squat 100 kilos? Yeah, of course I can.
Yeah, but if you're saying it's taken person and...
But yeah, so weight, the squat stand, squatting, I think the squat stand will take 220 by itself.
Yeah, it's more the bench.
Will take 220 combined.
Yeah, but sure, if you're benching 100 kilos, like...
Yeah, I'm probably a way away from that.
I think, well... I don't know.
I used to lift quite heavy, but it's been a long time, and my body creaks a lot more now than it used to. If I get anywhere near 100 kilos now, I'd be probably pretty pleased.
Well, it's one of the things that they say that as men age, one of the best things they can do is just lift heavy as a kind of staying healthy thing.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's great for your joints. It's great for your heart. And flexibility is one of the key issues and with muscle wastage as you get older.
Yeah, exactly.
And I am quite old.
No, you're not.
I feel quite old.
Well, that's different. Very different. And what about our other guests?
Oh, yeah, it's a great question, Fintan. I'm glad you're here. I mean, I'm glad you're here anyway, but I'm particularly glad now. And then Alberto and Paul, we had a great chat with them and founded a new movement. And then we had Roz Wade and Sharon Singleton from AG Brief on. I did, you know, I've used the wrong brand in there, haven't I?
Oh, you've done it again, haven't you? You do this every time.
I really do.
Oh my God.
What's it called?
I don't know. You do your friends.
But I always get it wrong.
So the website is agbrief.com. And I think that's, but I don't think that's how they brand it. One sec.
It's Asia Gaming Brief.
Asia Gaming Brief. And then the email address they use is agbrief, which is what causes your confusion.
Yeah. Damn it.
I know.
Damn
so they've eyes. They've got a great podcast, which we'd highly recommend.
Yeah, it's very good.
They've got the big event coming up, which we'd highly recommend.
Yeah.
And they also do video interviews.
Video interviews, yeah.
Which got a little bit sticky.
But they're a nice length of video interviews, about 15 minutes. And
okay, that's good. So
I think Sharon hosts them, if I remember correctly.
She's really smart. I'm not surprised. Yeah, she does, yeah.
Yeah, she is. Well, I mean, they're both just awesome guests.
They are.
And, you know, AGB is a great product. We should get one of the founders on, Lewis, but I bet he won't come on. He's probably too busy smoking cigarettes and looking cool. But I'm a big fan. And yeah, so with those guys, we were talking about everything that's gone on in the Philippines with the elections, and the result of that. And the urban myth surrounding new president Bongbong. We talk about Macau, the proposed tax. Well, I say proposed tax cut. I think somebody pulled that off a toilet wall or something, and clampdowns on people leaving China to gamble. A little bit of an update on other parts of Asia and Australasia. Bit of crown and star talk. Yeah, they're just superstars. I'm a big fan. So anything you want to know about that part of the world, listen to this or, you know, go find their stuff because it's really, really good.
Yeah, definitely get on their mailing list and read their website.
I'm a big fan. With all that said, I guess we can just crack on with the episode.
Yeah, enjoy the show.
We kick off this week's episode with a superstar returning guest, none other than the former Rose Bowl superstar, the Pinball Hall of Fame beer inner, and principal of Apollo Gaming, Tom Neiman. Hello, Tom.
Good morning or afternoon or whatever it is.
Well, you know, cover both bases because you just never know where somebody's listening to this.
We're in different continents.
True story. So, Tom, you're not here to talk about Japan today. We are going to discuss Sweet Home Chicago.
Yeah, right in the backyard.
Literally, Tom's getting a casino in his actual backyard.
The people who think that they're getting a casino in their backyard in the city are very pissed off.
Really, Tom? That's never happened before.
No, we've never heard of that story.
But then Chicago, right? I mean, if popular detective fiction is to be believed, and I'm a huge fan of Sarah Paretsky. I'm currently reading her latest release. And her number one character is the Chicago-based detective, V.I. Wachowski. She seems to think that Chicago is the ultimate city where money talks. Is that going to be the case with the casino? Or are the naysayers? What's going on? Where are we at, Tom?
Does money not talk anywhere?
My house. It's so quiet. It's got no voice. Hello? Hello?
You know, we've talked so many times about the casino in Chicago. It goes back decades, actually. But as of late, you know, there were five people chasing it, five proposals. And the mayor cut it to three. And just recently, a couple weeks ago, the mayor, ta-da, picked number one.
I'm pretty sure when they did this picking thing, I think they used a very new scientific method. I think that they put all the choices on a dartboard, put a blindfold on somebody, and they threw darts at it.
Total transparency, according to the mayor. She's been open, and this has been a detailed process, and everyone has had their voice, and they have come to the conclusion that and Bally's in the River West Development Project is the best opportunity for the city.
What are the issues with the proposal?
There's pluses and minuses. I'd say on the plus side, they're promoting obviously the fact that there's 3,000 construction jobs. There's 3,000 permanent jobs once the casino opens. Bally's is making a $40 million upfront payment to the city, which just, if timing is correct, the mayor will have in her hands just prior to re-election campaign.
Well, that'll always help.
Always a good thing to say what you've done for the city. And they're desperate. They're desperate to pay off the pensions on the fire and police pensions. And this kind of money is what's needed to help move them forward to generate the tax situation. Now, this may be the most taxed casino in the history of gaming. It had been originally on paper at 72% taxation.
Is that all?
Modified and now has been reduced within the city to only 40% taxation, which still makes it one of the highest in the country.
It's a big difference between 72 and 40. Are those dartboard figures?
Yeah, no, they had to be negotiated down. Nobody was actually submitting a proposal and the 72 is a projected, whether it was that high or not, but it was extraordinarily high. They were getting little response from the major players, and so they went into a modification, and they've reduced it. It's now going to come off at about 40% realization. So highly taxed, but they've got bills to pay, so they have to get that money. Hmm.
So high tax, lots of jobs, lots of construction jobs. What are the main issues that the naysayers are jumping all over? They can't be saying, oh no, it's going to bring crime. We're talking about Chicago. It's already there.
Well, of course, the local residents in the wards that the site is going to be. Now, the site is interesting. It's 30 acres on the Chicago River, North Chicago River, and it's the Tribune printing facility where the Tribune used to be printed. They've now, I guess, moved. But that facility is available, and they're going to tear it down and build this $1.7 billion facility, integrated resort, full integration with 3,000-seat theater, 500-room hotel, 6 restaurants and a food court, 3,400 slot machines. That's 3,400, 170 tables and 3,000 permanent jobs, as I mentioned. So,
thank you for translating the number there.
Well, I know the translation from U.S. to the U.K.
To real numbers, yeah.
3,400 slots, just like everything you see, right?
So the question is, right, does Chicago need something on this scale? Are we talking fairly central? Because when we read about these things, it's like it's putting it into actual context. How central are we talking? Is it like smack in the middle of Chicago? Is it going to be? Is it in a big tourist area?
It's on the west side of the loop where the Chicago River enters into the city. It is a residential area now, but certainly right on the edge of the city and can be turned into an entertainment area. Now, those whose backyards it will be in are a little bit pissed off. 80 to 85% negative attitude towards a casino. Don't want it.
Wow.
But in that immediate area, city can justify anything on the greater good. And the greater good is it's going to generate millions and millions in tax revenue and to help help the city with infrastructure. And
what's the sort of demographic of the area where it's going to be then? I mean, are we talking, is it a poorer area?
It's a real mix. There is some upscale in the immediate vicinity, but there is a true broad spectrum of city people in the nearby walk to areas. And so that's why it came also with a promise from Bally's of a 60% minority hire. So that was very attractive to the city also.
I know this is probably going to sound like a really stupid question, but what is classed as a minority in Chicago?
I guess non-Caucasian.
Okay. So, but is it, I mean, in terms of the overall city demographic, is it a city with a large Latino population? Is there, as, are there yes. Native Americans there? I mean, I genuinely don't know.
It's Latino and black. It's black and brown is the minority population. And it's an underserved community. And they desperately need good paying jobs. And so it's
and skilled, yeah.
If in fact the promises are kept, over 3,000 construction jobs, 3,000 permanent casino jobs, and if they match or meet this 60% minority hire, it would be a huge positive for the city.
Well, yeah, Chicago's not had the best time of late, I think it's fair to say. And not just because you moved back.
Noticeably, when I moved back, things went south. The city is got a great, I mean, it's a huge tourist destination. It's a huge meeting destination in the Midwest. Sits right on a beautiful lake shore of Lake Michigan. And I mean, this is a city that when you look around the world, the major urban environments all can handle a situation like this. And with a major integrated resort, almost, you know, they're saying 1.7. That's today. By the time the thing is built, it'll be over $2 billion investment on the part of Bally's. And it'll be their showcase. You know, today I think they operate 14 different casinos around the United States.
Well, they've had explosive growth, haven't they? I mean, the last 2 years have gone mad.
Soo Kim, who is the CEO of Bally's, was running Standard General Hedge Fund, and they were heavily invested in media, television, and casinos. And they owned a major portion of Twin Rivers, which had a handful of properties throughout the Midwest. They acquired it. Then they bought, in 2020, they bought Bally's in Atlantic City from Caesars, and they got the rights to the name Bally's. And with that, they rebranded the entire company, and all the properties were converted at that point to the Bally brand.
It is a very canny acquisition, I must say.
Well, it is, because we all know when we say Bally's, we always think of, you know, this is a pinball company here based in Chicago, started in 1932 by Ray Maloney, and they moved into casinos and they moved into slot machines and health clubs, fitness equipment. I mean, Bally's acquired everything up and through into the 90s and then started shedding a lot of these companies, and the fitness equipment and the health clubs got spun off.
But they also acquired a young Tom Neiman.
Well, I worked my very first job, 1972. I went to work for Bally.
And was, so that was that the year after the Rose Bowl, Tom?
Yeah, 2 years actually. It was January of 70, so it was 2 years after that. But I'm not sure what that has to do with it. But thank you for working that in.
I love that you played in the Rose Bowl. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, look, I'd be working into every conversation, Tom. I think you're being far too modest.
If I were you, Tom, and I were doing this interview, I would be sitting there, even though this is on audio, wearing an I Played in the Rose Bowl t-shirt, drinking out of an I Played in the Rose Bowl mug, eating my cereal out of a rose bowl.
All right. Well, you can close your eyes and imagine all those things.
But I've done it, Tom. I've drawn a picture of it. That's what I've been doing. I haven't been sitting there making notes. I've been drawing a picture of you.
Realize the podcasts are clicking off as we speak.
They're clicking on, Tom. They're clicking on.
Bally Entertainment, which was the Las Vegas and the Atlantic City casinos, was acquired by Hilton at some point, and Hilton sold it to Caesars, and Caesars sold it to Mr. Kim. And so Mr. Kim rebranded all his properties under the Bally's name. And so when you come into a city like Chicago, that name, if you don't know the backstories, you know, it sounds like the original Bally's that was here in Chicago. So, smart man.
How so just one slightly technical question. So I'm kind of like a, my background's online gambling and websites and stuff. So when you say a resort or one of these casinos can cost like 2 to 3 billion, for me, that's just a mind blowing sum of money. How
that could get you half a bonus finder.com.
Easy now. How does that, sorry, let me start this again. Are land-based casino operators, are they casino operators or are they property developers, I suppose, at heart? Because I'm assuming they've got to go raise, you know, issue debt and raise loads of money to them.
Certainly. And Kim's background, having started Standard General Hedge Fund, I mean, raising money is what this man has done his whole life. So raising that kind of money for an investment, for an intelligent investment, very attainable. And you're right. We're seeing today every major casino investment are in the $1.5 to $2.5 billion neighborhood. And that's what it takes to build a facility that is all encompassing, you know, with rooms, a casino, entertainment, theaters, probably meeting space, things like that. It takes that kind of money. And they're moving forward and ready to spend it. And I don't think finding the money to invest in it will be the challenge. The challenge ahead of them is, how do I get this thing approved in the area that you want to build it in? And within a city the size of Chicago, yes, there is strong disapproval in the immediate area where it's being built. But overall in the city, they see it as the potential revenue generator, so they can take care of some of these issues, things like fire and police pensions, of which that's been a can that has been kicked down the road for decades. The money is due for these pensions. And now this looks like a potentially viable way to address the financial issues that are facing both the state of Illinois and the city of Chicago.
And I know these are really technical questions, so it's okay if it's out of scope, but right now it's kind of like record inflation rates. The Fed is pushing up interest rates, and it looks like that's going to continue for a while. So if you're a developer, and let's say you've been lucky enough to get the prime location that you want, by the time you start building and finish building, your cost base for all your, just your raw materials and stuff, is going to have increased. You've borrowed money, and you'd assume there's some sort of variable rate on that. So I'm just wondering, given the current economy and the way everything looks like it's going, is there a chance casinos could go bust or big projects get canceled?
And we've seen that happen, where the best idea, the best concepts don't come to fulfillment. I mean, everything is built on projections. And if you don't meet those projections, and you don't generate the revenue that you project out, you can't meet your obligations. For example, I think it was Union Gaming did an assessment of a downtown Chicago casino. And it said it would take 6 years to reach maturity. And it would, by sixth year, it would be doing $816 million in gross gaming revenue. So a project like this has to meet those kind of projections to pencil out, especially when you're paying at a tax rate of around 40%. You know, the Las Vegas Strip taxes out, I think today it's 8% on gross gaming revenue. And here you've got an urban environment that wants to collect, a state and city that collects 40%. So it's an absolute risk. That's why, you know, in that final three that they had, was Rivers Casino, which is Rush Street Gaming, real estate magnate Neil Bloom, his company. And you had Hard Rock. And you'd have to stand back and say, well, gee, where was Caesars? Where was MGM? Where are those big players? Wynn. Well, they don't chase properties that they can do better with their money than pay a 40% tax rate. So they're off chasing much better situations. So that's why we're with the companies that we had and the final choice of Bally's.
Interesting. So it's a much higher risk scenario than you
would realize. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's going to get approved. The mayor is completely behind this. Obviously, the local residents, and I say local, those within the wards that this will be located in, are against it. But for the greater good of the city, they need to have this property open. And especially with an agreement to pay $40 million up front, just as soon as it's approved, they'll write a $40 million check to the city. And the projection by the mayor, the casino should shed about $440 million a year in various taxes at all levels. So it's a substantial tax generator if successful. And that's always the big question of if successful. And they've got the mayor's, the checklist of what the steps are. You need the mayor's approval. You need to be approved by the city council, which is made up of these aldermen. And you need the approval, obviously, of the Illinois Gaming Board, the IGB. Now, they've got the mayor's green light, and they'll be going into the city council soon, sometime this year, and fighting it out in there so everyone decides who gets what. And once that's done, the city council will approve it. And then it goes to the Illinois Gaming Board to make sure that everybody associated with Bally's is on the up and up.
Right. I'm sorry if we have covered this already. I don't believe that we have. But I meant to ask it earlier, and I don't think I did. Why was Bally's the preferred entrant in this? Was it the dartboard method?
No. Well, I mean,
maybe
it was mayor's method. So what it really was, we don't know because we weren't behind those closed doors. Now she has repeatedly said that she came out and spoke to everybody and all three proposals. The other two being Hard Rock, which was down on the lakefront adjacent Soldiers Field. That's where the Chicago Bears play, a mammoth old structure right on the lakefront where the Chicago Bears play their professional football down there. That was the Hard Rock. And then the Rivers proposal, which was Neil Bloom's proposal, is it's called the 78s. It's in the South Loop area. So it would be on the south side of the Chicago Loop, a little bit out of the way from a tourism standpoint. But the city, the mayor, felt that the best proposal was this River North proposal that sits right on the Chicago River inland from the lake a little bit. So, and I'm not positive that they offered the same incentives like the $40 million up front that Bally's did. But obviously they're all projected size-wise. They were all in the same kind of neighborhood that I described. I think the Rivers was 1.6 something billion and Hard Rock was 1.75. So they were all basically size-wise and offering-wise very similar. It was only the physical locations that varied between the three of them.
Okay. When is all this project? What's the time scale for this?
There's a temporary casino that is proposed. They're allowing, they're signing an agreement. Bally's is signing an agreement. We have a building right downtown called Medina Temple. And it had been a, I'm not sure what that meant, Medina Temple. But it was a big square building. I remember being in it once. It was converted to retail at one point. They've all moved out or gone south. And so they're taking over this temporary building. And that can be opened fairly quickly, probably by next year in some sort of temporary fashion. The permanent casino in construction will probably be very late 2026, more likely 2027.
So it's just around the corner then, really, kind of. No, it's quite, but then again, it's a massive project.
$5 million, 5-year project then at 2027. And you know, everyone is pledging they're going to help fast track it, et cetera. But it's a big city. There's lots of hands out. There's everybody who wants to get theirs. It will inevitably take 4 to 5 years.
Okay. Fenton, you got any other questions? It can just be about Chicago.
It could just be about Chicago.
Tom, does everybody in Chicago read Sarah Paretsky's books?
No, I mean she is a known author, and we all know that a good author has been very successful, right?
Yeah. She's the only author I buy all of her books in hardback.
Really? This is where I display my complete lack of education. Who are we talking about?
So a crime writer called Sarah Paretsky. She bases almost all of her books in Chicago with the same central character. But she's been hugely, and I don't think this has been fully appreciated, but she's been hugely influential on the genre. And the emergence of her character, V.I. Wachowski, and the sort of form of her books and the form of the character arc, etc., has, I would say, probably had a greater influence on the genre than anything else in the last 40 or even 50 years.
If we were going to theme a slot machine on her books, what would you call it, Jen?
Ooh, that's a great question.
That is a great question.
Wow.
Maybe it's a series of machines.
Wow.
Hell, that could be a new podcast. We could do that next week.
Do you know, it's weird. I mean, I know her books sell really well, and they sell well enough in the UK to come out in hardback in the UK, but I only know one other person that's ever read them. Just one. Maybe they're just too highbrow. As if
she a highbrow book. The backdrop, I doubt it's highbrow.
But it's you know, when a city is used so intimately in a book, it becomes almost another character. And I feel so much like I know Chicago because I think the recent one, the one that came out last week, is like the 22nd book with the character, I think.
Oh, my God.
And 21 of those are set in Chicago. There's only one that's set outside the city. And they're brilliant. But it's not like your sensationalist crime thrillers. They're more like a procedural kind of thing in which detective work can be really dull and nothing might happen. But it's all about that character and the arc and the character developing and aging. You know, a female detective who has to change how she operates as she gets older.
Sure.
Oh, so good.
I'm
probably going to finish the latest one tonight. I love her books. I think she's a tremendous writer.
Okay. Well, do you get paid something by them to promote the books?
I get nothing. I mean, don't even get me started on John Hughes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean,
we can go on and on forever for what John Hughes and the influence of Chicago.
But you know, John Hughes films, they came up at exactly the right age for me. So Breakfast Club would have been about 84. I think Ferris Bueller was 86.
Breakfast Club was filmed at Nutria West, which is about 5 minutes from my house.
So Tom, when they build the new casino, can I come and visit and will you show me some John Hughes places?
Absolutely. I'll take you to the Home Alone house.
Do you know, I'm not that fussed about Home Alone because he only wrote it. I say that he also only wrote Pretty in Pink and Some Kind of Wonderful, and they're both pretty classic. But, it's the teen stuff that I love so dearly.
But hang on a second. He did Weird Science, The Breakfast Club.
Yep.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Wrote and directed these.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yep.
Uncle Book.
Yep.
Home Alone.
Yep.
And Beethoven.
It's a hell of a purple patch, isn't it?
Uncle Buck's just opened here in Wilmette. Great sandwich shop, Uncle Buck's. I'll take you there for a sandwich.
Now you're talking.
Fantastic. What a career. And there was other, I've just listed the ones I watched as a watched and loved when I was younger.
But the Home Alone house, they had to put up about a 10-foot fence because people literally would just walk up the driveway and go to the door and ring the bell.
I think Airbnb did some sort of stunt where you could rent the house on Airbnb.
Jesus.
It was a good PR stunt.
They're all out of the North Shore, which is the suburbs north along the lake from Chicago.
Okay. But I said about Peretzky and her influence on the detective genre, which was, massive, and I don't think it'd be fully appreciated until she's not there anymore. But John Hughes actually, damn nearly created that genre. The actual teen movie as we understand it today.
Right. And a kid who really benefited from that, Bill Murray. Bill and I went to high school together.
No way.
Yeah, Billy.
I told you, Tom's had a hell of a life.
He was my junior counselor in summer camp. Because he was a year younger.
It's just bonkers, right? I mean, you have these conversations with Tom and this stuff just kind of creeps out. I mean,
because it's like one of those casual, oh, you mean Billy? Yeah, I know Billy.
Well, there were all the Murray brothers. There were just a boatload of them. And it just, which one was crazier than the next? And honest to God, the character he's played in all those movies, that was him growing up. I mean, he doesn't act. He just does what he does.
I watched recently a movie about the guy who was one of the co-founders of National Lampoon.
Yeah.
I saw it on Netflix and I can't remember for the life of me what it was called, but it was very funny. It was a guy, I can't remember his name even. This is terrible. He died very, very young. But it's about that whole period and the influence that it had on comedy. And that, they had all these guys work in National Lampoon, and then a very canny producer came along and said, hey, you should all write for this TV show. And so Saturday Night Live was born.
Oh, wow. Is that where it came from?
Basically.
Did I tell you the story? I was running when I was working at Bally in the pinball division. I ran a national tournament and the finals were here at the Playboy Towers. So I brought in all these young kids to the Playboy Towers.
Nice.
To play in the national finals pinball contest. And I needed some life to the event. So I called Billy in New York. He was doing Saturday Night Live. And so I said, kind of desperately need your presence. So he jumped on a plane. He said, pay my flight and my room and my drinking bill, and I'll do it. And he came out with Rosanna Dana. What's her real name?
Roseanne Barr? No.
The character from Saturday Night Live.
No, this would have been way before that.
But the two of them show up and Billy grabbed the microphone and just freelanced and made it hilarious. So it was big success.
Rosanna Dana. I'm just trying to figure out who it is. Just bear with me. Gilda Radner.
Bill came out with Gilda Radner and for the weekend and stayed at the Playboy Towers. And we ran the event and he was a big hit.
And to bring it full circle, of course, so National Lampoon, all their writers got poached for Saturday Night Live. But one of their writers that didn't go to Saturday Night Live was John Hughes, who wrote National Lampoon's Vacation and and I think he wrote the second National Lampoon's Vacation movie as well, which of course was a big thing in Chevy Chase's career.
Sure.
Chicago.
Where it took place.
Sweet, sweet home Chicago. And the Blues Brothers, Chicago. Oh. I mean,
it's, yeah. Everything was centered around living and growing up in Chicago.
It's no coincidence, Tom, that after leaving Vegas, you've settled in this hub. You're in the heart of the buzz now, and people like me are going to be contacting you and saying, Tom,
just a hub of excitement.
Tom, come and talk about Chicago. Come and shoot the shit with us. So, will you come back when something else happens?
Sure. When they move forward, when they go down the line and I don't know, pen meets paper and everything's official.
When something gets held up for 6 months because of union organization.
The ribbon cutting in 5 or 6 years, I'll be on for that. I'll say.
Is Chicago still a big union town?
Huge union town. And Bally's has already agreed that it will be a union location.
Yeah, they would have had a lot of trouble if they hadn't done that, I think. That would have been a deal breaker, I bet.
Yeah, it would have been dicey if they had said no.
But, you know, times change, things evolve. Tom, thank you for joining us. And thank you for telling us stories about Bill Murray.
John, always good to talk to you. And Fintan, good to hear your voice.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Gentlemen, I bid you adieu.
We move on to our second guests, I should say. Fintan has ducked out for a minute. I say ducked out. He's just being busy and important somewhere. Probably buying watches and binge watching season 2 of Cobra Kai. I am joined by, I suppose it's the royal we. Yeah. We're joined by Spinton. Spinton's here in Ferret. Fintan is here in spirit. We are joined by Alberto Alfieri, CEO and co-founder of Jada Gaming, and Paul Crisp, Chief Marketing Officer of Simplify. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. John, you started by saying you do very little editing, but it sounds like that introduction is going to require some serious patching up there.
No, it's going to go in exactly like that. Fintan once recorded an episode from a hotel room. And a member of the hotel staff knocked on the door and asking him questions. And, they were like, I thought you were checking out today. I was like, no, I'm not checking out today. I'll stay for another day, blah, blah. I left the whole thing in because I thought it was hilarious.
Good morning, John. But the question is, why are we not with Fintan?
Yeah, he obviously he thought, he's too big these days. He's almost too big for this podcast. Since he sold his business, he's just like, he's so important, you wouldn't believe. do you two watch Cobra Kai?
Oh, I do. I did.
Unfortunately, I'm a no there.
Fucking hell, Paul.
Yeah.
I know. You don't get time to watch. He's got kids and stuff. You don't get time to binge.
Oh, there's a lot of time between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m.
But that's a good shout. Exactly. Like a true drinker.
Exactly. Yeah, you do that and you feel like death the next day. No, it's for me, it's been, I don't know. It's been The Crown. I quite enjoyed it. You know what I mean, because I'm an Englishman living in Stockholm, so you kind of semi-miss England occasionally, bits of it. So that's been interesting.
And The Crown is your way of seeing home. Jesus, what was your house like in England, Paul?
Exactly. Well, that's the thing. I'm of noble blood, as you understand. No, I'm not. No, I mean, literally, I'm from southeast London, so I'm about as far removed from the royal family as you could possibly get. But I don't know. I just kind of quite like the motors and stuff from the kind of early 80s, kind of like a princess, Morris princess. And so my mum had one of those. It kind of, warms my soul, nostalgia.
Probably not a lot of capris in there, though.
There was a capri. There was a capri, like I think in the last season. It was one of those really nice 2.8. Do you remember the kind of black one with the skirting around the bottom? Mm-hmm. It was a quality car, handled like a shopping trolley, apparently. But
do you remember the Mark II Escort?
Yeah.
It's now, classic. I don't know about in Stockholm, but there's a syndrome named after that. But I see a lot of Mark II Escorts on the road because apparently it's something to do with the chassis being made of steel.
Yeah.
That they're perfect for rallying.
Yeah, that was. I think one of the most successful rally chassis of all time. I mean, it's just an absolutely incredible motor.
I don't know anything about cars. How would I even know that? Jesus.
Because the Mark II is such a design classic, John, that it's gone into your psyche, even though you don't like. I don't really like cars either. But the Mark II Escort, you have to tip your hat.
I spent my early years in a very poor area of Derby, and there are a lot of like Mark III Cortinas, Mark II Escorts, really shitty Capris, the Mark I Capri actually, and that kind of thing. You know, the odd Hillman Imp. Sadly, that was on our drive. And that kind of thing. So shit cars from the 1970s, I remember quite well.
It's funny how you say Mark 1, Mark 2, Mark 3. Like, because I remember that growing up. I couldn't tell you what mark the current Ford Focus is. I've got no idea. All cars look the same now. But back in the day, it was like, yeah, oh, that's a nice, that's a Mark 3 Escort.
But apparently, that all cars look the same now is a good thing because there are fewer insects dying on our windscreens. And I reckon that that's down to greater aerodynamics. And it's a true story, apparently. It's great down to greater aerodynamics in the cars.
Well, they've got, I mean, basically there's so much floor share now. So everyone, you just buy the chassis, don't you? I remember watching a video on YouTube and it was about like the Volvo 740, the absolute monster kind of estate here. And they ploughed it into like this kind of brand new tiny Renault to show how much kind of safety is improved from a car versus the 80s. Versus a modern car now. And, you know, they plow into each other at full speed. And it's absolutely terrifying. And there's nothing left of either car. But you look in the capsule of the small Renault, and it is actually the driver is okay. The Volvo driver dies. Obviously, the crash test dummies. And I remember the first comment on YouTube said, I'd rather die in a Volvo than survive in a Renault.
I totally share it.
Wow.
We're shifting the focus here from Cobra Kai. Yeah.
It's a good shout, Alberto. So we've been having a straw poll on this podcast, and we've come to the conclusion so far that Netflix is lying about its viewing figures, because using the Gambling Files podcast as a what's the phrase I'm looking
reference.
For? Yes, as a reference for as a microcosm, shall we say, for mm-hmm. for. The streaming society as a whole, about 1% of people actually watched Cobra Kai, which we're shocked and disgusted by it.
I mean,
very disgusted. But I have to say that there was also the possibility of watching from YouTube, which is not to be disregarded statistically wise.
It's true, but that was only the first two series.
True that. True that.
You're blowing
the scandal
wide open.
Yeah. I guess we need to accept that we are a minority.
We are, and a victimized minority.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, so. I see a movement growing here, Alberto. Would you join me in Cobra Kai Matters?
Cobra Kai Years, yes. I would definitely join that board.
Cobra Kai Matters. We're going to have CKM logo t-shirts.
I'm not and, for it.
And I'm not belittling any actual significant social movements here at all. I'm if anything, just copying them and trying to piggyback on their success.
Let's copy with pride.
Yeah, well, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, especially for Cobra Kai Matters. We're, you know, we stand with our oppressed brothers and sisters. And if we stand with everybody that's oppressed, unless you're an asshole, and then, you know, we'll just join in oppressing you probably.
Obviously, I'm going to have to watch at least one episode when I get home tonight. So, you know, in that sense, the awareness campaign has already been incredibly effective.
Age-wise, Paul, you're probably just right.
I'm 42.
You're probably just right for it.
All right.
Because you would have watched Karate Kid when you were a kid.
Oh, it's that one. Okay, yeah, I haven't seen it, but I've seen it on in the background once when someone else is watching it. Yeah, no, that exactly. Yeah, there's no reason why I wouldn't love that. So,
it's excellent. I mean, I really mean it. It will surprise you, and you will fall in love with it. It's genuinely excellent, and William Zabka is just brilliant.
Well, we could segue with Netflix and recommendations here.
Well, we got to get some income from somewhere. I got to be honest. So I'll take any old shit right now. So, but gentlemen, we have segued a little there. I think it's fair to say.
Just a little.
We actually didn't get you on here to talk about that. I just got to stop. Almost got rid of that cold. It's only been like, what, 2 months?
You're fascinated doing that.
Simplify has strengthened its solution with AI-powered hyper-personalization, say that when you're drunk, and recommendation software, right? And so that's correct. What we got you on here to talk about. Now, first things first, Alberto, you're with Jada Gaming, which was acquired by Simplify, yeah?
Correct,
so
yes.
So does that mean that Paul owns you and I should address all my questions to him?
More or less, yes.
Absolutely. Alberto's the
sensei.
Exactly. Alberto's the architect of Simplify AI, which is obviously the child, if you will, of what's coming from our glorious union after the acquisition of Jada Gaming. So it's an incredibly exciting phase for us all, both Alberto and I as new parents to
Simplify
AI.
Two quick questions. I'll get the ugly questions out of the way first. Is it actually exciting, and is it actually different? Because everybody
it
says
is.
That shit.
No, you know, I've always been, let's put it, accused to be too blunt and too straightforward.
You're on the right podcast, Alberto.
I know. That's why I love the feeling since the first moment here. I feel literally feel at home. And you're right. I mean, people tend to use and abuse the words incredible, you know, exciting.
Groundbreaking. Don't get me started when I see groundbreaking. Use groundbreaking
yes.
when it's a fucking building site and they've broken ground.
Yeah, or an earthquake. That works.
Yeah, totally. That's a big one. Volcano. Fair enough.
Yes, but sorry. In this case, I got to say, it is exciting. It is exciting because it's just, you know, the feeling that you have when you get a big, difficult puzzle and you complete it and you see the results after, you know, the bits and that you're matching and combining. That is the feeling that I guess we have. I think, you know, where that feeling when you know, the A-Team Orwell is the actor, the leader of the A-Team series, when it says, I love when a plan comes together.
George Peckard, you know, Hannibal in the A-Team.
Yes, Hannibal, yes. You know, we keep the references now to the A-Team series. But yes, that is absolutely the feeling. When you see something that you built or partially built, because in this case we're merging two technologies, and you just see and feel that it makes sense and it just gets better.
What is the end goal of this software, though? I mean, I read out the headline of the press release, Simplify, Strengthen, Solution with AI-powered hyper-personalization and recommendation software. And there's a lot of buzzwords in there. You know what I mean? Yeah. It sounded like a swarm of bees coming out of my mouth.
Bee buzzwords.
What's the actual end goal?
The end goal is to be able to have a CRM team that can log in with one single login into a platform, which, you know, essentially covers absolutely every element of their daily work, of what they need to do. Because the thing is, both Alberto and I can't speak too heavily for Alberto, but I know he has got a lot of experience of it. But I am an old iGaming CRM kiddie. And I remember like the kind of multiple logins to like 1,001 different systems to kind of get everything to work and to hang together. And that's kind of still the case quite a lot for quite a lot of people. Even when you meet, you know, I can't name anyone, but when you meet bigger labels now, it's like people are like, oh yeah, we use this tool for that and then that tool for that. It's just a monster headache. And we kind of feel like all of these tools, they're essentially kind of, they have a synergy between them, which is the data that they're trying to get a push or a pull on their database and what they, you know, they want their customers to come in and come back. So for us, that's kind of the end goal or the strategy that we're working on. And I think that we're already delivering. And I know what you mean by exciting and stuff. I mean, obviously I'm contractually obliged to say it's very exciting. But it genuinely is exciting. I mean, I sit in customer meetings now or like kind of sort of prospect meetings where you meet people and I start to see the stuff kind of propping up now from the kind of analysis coming from Josh and from Alberto, coming into our tool saying, okay, well let's have a look at the kind of churn prediction and stuff. And what would we like? Could we launch a customer journey against that? So, i.e., if there's someone's got a propensity to stop sort of playing or whatever, we can send off a customer journey. And it's like it is sometimes a bit like, even when I saw it, it was like showing a dog a card trick. I was like, holy shit. It really, for me, it's so exciting in that sense. I could go back into iGaming now and then I could work with it without getting a brain embolism, because it would be that much more effective to work with it, because it is just a huge conundrum and everything comes down to there's just such a mountain of data to deal with.
Listening to your delightful South London accent, I did have an idea for the marketing for you.
Hit me.
And just bear with me here. Picture Ray Winston in the 1970s. Circa Scum. Do you remember Scum?
You run B-Wing, but you run it for me.
Exactly. Banged up 23 and a half out of 24. That movie, right? All that talk of tools had me thinking, Ray Winston looks at the camera. Where's your tool?
What
fucking tool? This fucking tool. And then he pulls out his Simplify software.
This is true. I wonder. I can get in contact with the agent. I wonder what his fee would be for that. Where's your?
I think it's taken anyway.
Ray used one single tool there, and that's what we're aiming for.
It was a snooker ball in a sock, as I recall.
It was. What do you say? It was elementary but effective.
It really was, and a brutal film.
I didn't think we'd be talking about it during the pod, but that's good that you brought that memory back.
It's a tremendous. I used to when I worked at QVC. I was in the team
that
was developing
that intro.
I've had some really weird jobs. When I was working at QVC, we used to have a Scum day once a week. We'd have a day where everybody just talked as though they were in the movie Scum. And the one guy that I worked with, I mean, he was so posh sounding that you would not believe. And yet he did the most perfect Scum speak. And it was just glorious. He'd just be sitting there, you know, in his jacket, his tank top, tie and shirt. And he'd just look up at you and go, banged up in here, 23 and a half out of 24. Fucking hell.
And I think when you watch QVC, that really comes over. Do you know what I mean? You sort of...
I hope so.
You know, in the tapestry that is QVC, in between sort of, you know, a kind of commercial for a magic bullet.
And, it was a great job.
I mean, why would you leave a gig like that?
Well, I was there freelance and I was on a very small team developing some new technology. It was really interesting. And they realized that I was the only person that knew how to do everything that I did. And so they said, why don't you come work for us full time? We'll cut your pay in half. I'm like, can we just take one little step back?
Right.
Go back to that bit about pay again. But we've got a great dental plan. I said, I've got brilliant teeth. And that extends to partner and family. I'm like, I'm 25 and... I'm single and I'm probably going to stay single despite my excellent teeth. And they were like, and we got health plan. Let's go back to the part. I'm 25. And we got pension. I'm 25. I'd rather just have the more money part.
And as many magic bullets as you can take home.
But they were like, they just couldn't budge on that because they had a very rigid pay structure. So I ended up training two people to replace me, and they did very well for themselves, I think.
Well, that's okay. Good on QVC.
And I went to work for a pornographer.
Okay, that becomes interesting.
Anyway, it's...
Speaking of big data.
Oh, I see what you're doing there. To come full circle.
This was, yeah, we're starting from Scum and going to big data. I think we're getting there.
Fenton's going to shit himself when he hears this. So,
going back to the goal that you were mentioning, what's the objective here? I mean, I guess one of the cool thing is that we saw CRM in general going from being seen as an email dispatcher, basically, a few years ago, to a really powerful and I would say almost endless tool in terms of whenever it comes to the customer relationship management. Because I think the range of opportunities for improving the customer experience from, the quality of the work that you offer is just not comparable to a few years ago, thanks to the AI, of course, as well. And in this case, it was Simplify, where they had a solid software already and 20 years of experience in the market in multiple verticals. That was just heaven already.
It's a really lovely fit, and it was something we weren't even looking for. That was, I think, that's kind of adds to the sincerity of the deal.
Hang on, you bought Simplify, then you realized that you bought Jada, and then you realized they were going to be useful.
No. I mean, obviously, we were running them in sales. Yeah, luckily, but it was a synergy that took place even before the purchase. We were like, oh, wouldn't that? Yeah, a bit of water cooler chat, whatever they say in the US. We're like, oh, that would be wicked if we had something like that. And then we were like, well, it's not impossible to buy things. So that's the long and short of how we got here.
Yeah, and the clients as well, mutual clients. I mean, suggesting to speak one another. I think that was really cool and interesting.
Speaking of it not being impossible to buy things, this podcast is very much for sale. I've got two questions here from Fintan, so these are better questions. He wanted me to ask you, how does this integrate into existing software infrastructure? Is there, because this new system does a lot. You've got your CRM ecosystem and you've got this, which I'm assuming is modular. And you've got this new module, hyper-personalization recommendation software. If somebody wanted to use it, have they got to ditch everything that they're using and bring this in? Does it integrate? Can individual modules integrate? What does it actually mean for somebody that is a new customer?
Indeed, you touched there. It is modular, and customer doesn't need to ditch anything. The beauty is that we actually get in between, and the way they can... Let's assume they opted for the hyper-personalization module. In reality, there are different ways to use it, depending on the platform they're in, depending on the software provider, let's say, that they're using for their content management for their website. We can either integrate at that level or use our CRO solution to push and change the look and feel of the front end using the recommendations provided by the artificial intelligence. We are very, I would say, versatile and agnostic set of solutions because we have multiple modules and functionalities, and we do the work in adapting. So we act as a, I would say, you can shape our integration. We can shape our integration based on the customer needs.
Exactly. We just need the host of data coming in from the customer. I mean, typically people re-platform in this industry kind of often, but quite a lot. And it tends to be a kind of wholesale approach when they do take us on board of like, okay, well, we'll take it lock, stock and barrel. Because as I said, mentioned earlier, this, especially when you're dealing with kind of legislated markets as well, dealing with kind of multiple tools, it is a massive headache. So it's like with us, they'll have kind of from their raw data, basically just reams and reams and rows of player behavior, gaming data, the works, withdrawals, deposits, having that kind of like funneled into Simplify. And then at the end, having something that's incredibly well laid out, and you're able to kind of plot a strategy of okay, let's move forward into Q1, Q2. What are our goals? What are our aims in terms of reactivation, retention in terms of conversion on the existing marketing concepts that we're running. I think it's pretty epic in that respect.
Okay. Fintan, I hope you're happy with that.
I'm sure he will be.
I'm sure he will be. But one thing that he brought up, and he was trying to explain this to me, so I hope I've got this right. He asked, how is the user journey planned? So somebody like in at the start of this software journey, someone has to create a path which is extremely complex and has a never-ending bunch of options off it and destinations off it. Where does that end, and how do you make this easier for your customers? Because, I mean, that's the heart of this, right?
Exactly. I mean, and that's a superb question because it never ends. And, you know, I always think a player should always be in a journey, in a customer journey, always, at all times. There should never be any – there's kind of these stages like, okay, well, all these players are active, so they're all right. We'll just spend all the time on these players that aren't active. Because I can give you an example. I've had Spotify since 2008, which is an insane amount of time to have Spotify, and I've paid every month without question. My missus has had it like 1 or 2 years, then took a year out, then went back. Then she's at no end of offers saying, hey, come back, we'll give you half price, we'll give you 3 months for free. Me, the most loyal customer in the entire world, I've gotten diddly squat the entire time. They've just taken the money out of my account because I'm kind of lying in this kind of, oh, he's an active user, so we don't have to do anything. And I think, you know, that's daft. There's upsell opportunities there to kind of contact me. And at the same time, there's a fact you can handle me then as a, not a VIP necessarily, but, you know, make sure that I don't get tempted by Deezer or Apple Music or whatever it is and give me some kind of offer. So for us, the customer or the player should always be in a customer journey. And as you said, it is you do plot it out as a CRM team. You sit there. Our kind of big thing about our customer journey planner was if you look at it, ironically, it looks like a whiteboard and it's drag and drop. So and that idea came from whenever we would go and meet CRM teams, particularly in iGaming, there's no shortage of ideas. People are like, awesome. It's incredibly intelligent and very, very competent individuals. But the software wasn't there. So they would sit in this whiteboard and they kind of draw up the first 30 days. That was like a classic one. They need little boxes and arrows and lines. And some poor mug would get the job of taking the picture with their phone and then go back to their desk. And then they'd be like, right, how do we do this? And then they'd just sort of stare blankly at their campaign tool and be like, ah, not really possible. So for us, we developed the customer journey setup and the planner based exclusively on our findings when we had meetings with customers. Again, because they knew what they wanted to send on day 36 to a player that's come from a certain affiliate link because the CPA is slightly higher there. But then again, the player loyalty is again slightly higher, so it's worth investing. What Alberto and Josh do now is they give that type of information, which has typically been kind of quite insular within these organizations. They make it kind of, they democratize it in a way for the CRM team. So they're like, okay, well, here's all the data I need. This is what the LTV is going to be on these players. This is typically what the customer journeys that we want to use or the campaigns that we want to use. So yeah, in the very beginning, they sit there and they craft these kind of beautifully made journeys and then they're out of the box. So the minute a player fulfills some kind of criteria, it automatically launches. And as I said, I think, you know, like forgotten password, that sounds really daft, but we've noticed now with people with forgotten password, if someone's requested a new password, we send the password to them, obviously, via the our technology. But then at the same time, that's just a perfect opportunity because the player is keen, aren't they? They want to get back in. They want to get back into the infrastructure of your product. They want to get back into your site. They want to bet on the FA Cup final, which has literally just happened. So, like, why not start a customer journey on that, which is, you know, giving them more relevant kind of offers and information that they could have. So, you know, you can retain them for longer. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
And let me make it longer. You know, in the daily cases that we see, one of the biggest challenges for a CRM team is trying to juggle here to between what they want to do and what I can actually do. You know, with the data available, usually there's an insane amount of data available or will be available if it actually will be organized. So having the ability of saying, I want to focus on the customer that the system, that the AI feels that they are about to charge, it gives a possibility to the CRM team to make a strategy out of it and say, okay, let's plan for this not to happen anymore. So, you know, let's track this group. Let's message them. Let's engage with them. Let's understand what's going on, why they got there, so that they can focus on optimizing it. And I know this is another buzzword, optimizing it, that I quite dislike, but this is the reality here. So if you can focus on optimizing the journey prior to the customer getting to the point where it's about to churn, you are making the customer experience better, potentially saving money of your company, and making a better use of your time as a CRM manager or strategist.
Exactly.
Okay.
Everything comes down to customer experience. That's my personal feeling. And I remember working CRM there in iGaming and thinking, you know, this is a bit like a high street store in a sense. We're selling labels, i.e. kind of game titles that everyone else has as well. So it's the battle's won and lost on how you kind of handle your customer experience and your customer service in order to kind of retain your players, which are hard to come by as it is.
Yeah. It's what really sells at the end of the customer experience. I mean, you know, out of experience, why porn that sells so well and so easily? The customer experience must be great, I assume.
Well, Paul makes a good point there. You know, everybody's essentially selling the same stuff.
Yeah.
Or very similar stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know game studios and stuff like that, and I'm not dissing them when I say this, but they talk about the game mechanics and what that means and all that stuff. I have yet to see meaningful data that shows that influences actual player behavior.
Hmm.
You walk through a casino, an actual physical casino, you walk through the slot floor and people aren't walking around going, I don't like the volatility on this fucker. You know, they're just not doing that. Maybe it is having an effect very subconsciously, but it's likely to be more about inclusion. It's likely to be more about experience. Maybe even as simple as they like the color on the screen.
Yeah.
That's as likely to have a subconscious effect as anything else, as the mathematics.
Exactly. So if you've got that much of a tenuous relationship to the users, then why not try and enhance that part of it, if you like me?
It comes down to the experience. It comes down to...
Yeah.
So for example, I went to that catchily named Fijma show in Madrid, right? I completely cocked up my car parking booking. I got it badly. I booked the car park for like 10 days. And even when I paid for it, it was like 80 quid or something. I didn't even think twice about it. I thought, well, it's down south, isn't it? That'll be why it's really expensive. And I get back after, you know, being away for like 36 hours and they're like, excuse me. They're like, you're back early. I'm like, I'm not. I'm bang on time. No, we're expecting you in 8 days. Like, oh, shit. And I go and have a look at the booking and realize I've gotten it really, really badly wrong. They're like, contact customer services. They might be able to help. Contact customer services. And I said, look, I appreciate this is entirely my mistake and I recognize it's totally my mistake. Is there any chance you could transform this into a credit so that I can just use you again later in the year? And predictably, they said, there is literally no chance of that happening. And I said, well, okay, but this is your choice between keeping me as a customer and not keeping me as a customer. And that was that. In terms of customer service, on the shop floor, they were lovely. They were absolutely great. They went and got my car. They sorted me out, even though I'd gotten it badly wrong. And they were lovely about it. On the actual customer retention side, it was shite, and I'm not going to be their customer anymore.
Yeah.
And it's not about the money. I wanted them to keep the money. and I wanted to carry on using them. And that was the offer I made them. And they said, fuck you. So I said, okay, bye.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean,
we've gone everywhere in this conversation.
No, but it's true. Indeed. Every 10 euro or £10 note or £100 note is a voting ballot in many respects. Is the democratization of the consumer. If you don't like something, there's always going to be an alternative to it. It's very, very seldom there's a monopoly on something. Okay, you do have that in some markets. We have traditionally had it in Sweden for quite a long time. But a
monopoly on monopoly as well.
There is a monopoly on monopoly, and I think that has to be referred to the Monopolies Commission. And that's exactly what the Monopolies Commission should have been set up for.
Well, I think big board games is just investing money to keep the man down.
Well, this is the thing. Follow the money on that. Do you know what I mean? You get a lot of weird Monopoly spin-offs, like, I don't know, Game of Thrones Monopoly. I'm like, what? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Simpsons Monopoly and all that. Simpsons. Star Wars Monopoly. And they usually make them in very limited numbers, and that gives them the right to charge a lot more.
I think it's not kept up with property prices if you play the original.
No, it's true.
That's because Monopoly is the basically the game board representation of life. It's true life put in a board game represented form.
That is a little deep. That's why that podcast.
I'll keep it for another podcast.
Yeah, keep it for one of true the, life the,
there. The. Do they need to update the prices? I mean, if you can get a gaff in Islington for £80, I'll buy it. But you can't. Things have moved on. Okay, the Old Kent Road. That's probably semi-accurate still, but that's it.
Yeah, I mean, Mayfair, that's actually the cost per minute.
That's just the parking.
Yeah, exactly. Just the entrance in the area.
Per square inch.
Yeah.
And you get hotels.
Fundamentally, hyper-personalization is all about the user experience, and you guys are smashing it out of the park. Is that fundamentally what you're saying?
Absolutely. It's all about the customer experience. And the customer experience is going to come down to, you know, relevance. That the personalization is, you know, Alberto, chime in. It is where the battle will be won and lost, being as a people are kind of in competition with, as you said yourself, and I mentioned earlier, a similar product. It's not like there's two FA Cups you can bet.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you think about
hang on.
Sure.
This is my letting agent. I'm having a house inspection. Hello. Yeah, I'm just recording the podcast.
He's been smoking.
You've been about 15 minutes.
Yeah, is that okay?
Yeah, that'll be fine.
He's been smoking and he has pets.
I'll let you get back to your podcast.
Sweet, thank you. The gambling industry just heard you. Yeah, she hung up.
Yeah. That could have been a
totally
great
not editing that out.
Out. Have you been a good tenant?
Kind of. I've been a better tenant than the landlord has been landlord.
Yeah, that's not hard.
Okay.
It's really not. My house is a house that you'd love if you were into really retro things.
I am actually into really retro things.
Well, I've got the house for you because it was built in 1972 and still has the original kitchen and bathroom.
Oh, no, that is quality.
I'm not kidding.
That's a bit of a stretch for retro there.
Whereabouts is the house located?
It is in Prestine in Wales.
Oh, right, nice.
Mm. So it's a lovely town. The neighbours on the one side are, well, you know.
Do they listen to your podcast?
I don't know. I hope so. Les, Anne,
why don't you
invite
them?
Why are you not on the property ladder, John?
That's a great question. Moved around a lot, never earned very much money, drank a lot. and also, I had kids really late, which has probably been a small factor there. Hi, kids. I think that is a bit of a factor. And generally I'm broke. Also, I think, you know, in the UK now, if you don't inherit, you're probably not going to be getting on any kind of property ladder.
That is absolutely insane.
My parents didn't own anything. You know, I'm from an extremely working class family, and yes, I inherited nothing when they died. And that's that, really.
I feel bad for asking now, John. Sorry. I was just curious.
Yeah.
No, it's all right. I mean, it's a fair question. The area that I grew up, Ludlow, you know, I mean, it's a beautiful town and all that, but it's also one of those towns that people move to when they sell their house in St. Albans. And they sell their St. Albans semi for, you know, 700,000, realize they can buy a townhouse in the middle of Ludlow for 300, and it's twice the size of where they've come from.
Yeah.
And then they put the other bit into a rental property, and for their buy-to-let mortgage, the rent's got to be 120% of the rent, of the mortgage payments, etc. And so the rents go through the roof, and none of it has any bearing on the actual salaries people earn locally. So, you know, that is where I live.
The real world example of monopoly there.
Really is. Full circle. But it means that, you know, unless you bought in that area when you were like 20, as some of my friends did, you're not going to be buying a house there.
No.
Yeah, you go into like a fairly standard housing estate in Ludlow and it's full of BMW and Mercedes now. Well, I'm pretty sure they're not owned by the people I grew up with because they were real scum. Now,
a lot of Mark II Escorts.
Sadly, well, there are a few because there are some big rally enthusiasts in the area. Second or third vehicle, I guess. But it's just one of those things, you know. It's a nice place to live, and so the people that made it a nice place to live get squeezed out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hence, I now live in Prestine.
Nothing wrong with Prestine.
No, it's lovely. Big fan. Sorry, we digressed again. You two are terrible for staying on topic. Sorry, Alberto.
We're terrible. Yeah, I was saying, I just got curious now. I want to see you visit Prestine.
It is a lovely town. It's a very small town right on the border of Wales and England. Most of it's in Wales. And it's just, you know, a classic small town. But it's a thriving classic small town. It's a strong sense of community.
Oh, lovely.
And lots of small dogs.
That's what I was
about. Small dogs.
Yeah, but I have a very large dog. And small dogs are, well, he's been bitten on the dick twice. By Jack Russells.
But I'm sure. I don't know if physics involved. But surely a big dog could also do that if he bent down.
But he'd have to get right down because he's really tall.
Oh, all right. But that's
and the Jack Russells just like run under him and oh, I'll have that.
So Jack Russell, they are.
It's like,
they can be. I really feel terrible.
He's a great dog.
Jack Russells can be really aggressive.
But they can, and he's not aggressive, as most big dogs aren't. And you know, he just bounces around, thinks everybody's great. Sees Jack, well, let's play. No, get off my dick.
When I was a kid, I got bitten by Jack Russell. We were at a holiday home in Devon, I think. And the Jack Russell and the German Shepherd, they were like, you know, working dogs, like on a farm and stuff. They weren't like the way we get pets. And he nipped me, the Jack Russell one. I remember like the farmer, he kicked like the back of the dog, not hard, but he nudged it with his foot. And it, as being a city slicker, it kind of freaked me out a bit. And I think I was like 8, and I just asked him a really weird question. I said, what's the hardest you've ever kicked your dog? And I remember the guy went, oi, I scored a few goals.
Oh, my God, we're laughing about animal cruelty.
No, exactly. Yeah, it's just to be clear, we're not.
We're terrible people.
No, but that was, no, it was, it really did. I remember it shocking me. I think, you know, obviously, mercifully, things have improved rapidly. But he genuinely loved both the animals a great deal. I remember coming down after one summer and the German Shepherd had passed and he had a new one. And his missus was like, oh, he was heartbroken, locked himself in the toilet and all that. And I was thinking, oh, God. But they were like, you know, they were part of the staff on the farm.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of things that you shouldn't laugh at.
Like what? Because animals are like human beings.
Yeah, and, absolutely. Like
good ones, but also very annoying ones.
I'm not going to even talk about my dog that I lost because I'll just cry. And no, that was like exactly. 3 years ago, and I still cry about it. Although she is featured in the new book, she is a character in a novel that came out in February. The book is called The Gifts. It's by Liz Hyder, and Liz was a friend of my dog's. And so she put her in a book.
Immortalized in print. That's wonderful.
I know. I've read the book, and I just cried my eyes out. But speaking of things that you shouldn't laugh about, a friend of mine, he's just got this thing about just finding really obscure stuff. And things that you know are wrong. So the other night, he was visiting another friend. So we were all around this friend's TV set. And he found something called TSW's Man of the Year. And it was Television Southwest from 1982. It was essentially their regional Miss Southwest, but with men. And it was unbelievable and hilarious. But it was followed by my mates like, yo, you've got to see this. You're not going to believe this. And it was a program that had aired in the, I think, late 70s, early 80s. And it was, it had lots of childminders on. And it was a program that was about looking after other people's children. Hosted by Jimmy Savile.
Oh, God.
And when you watch that in the context of what you know now... It's you watch it through your fingers, you know what I mean? It's like, and I'm like a horror movie fan. I'll watch any old shit. But, and I was having this conversation with my friend who was giving him a lift home and saying, even with what we know now about that man, I still can't get my head around it. I can't get my head around the scale of it. I can't get my head around about just how fucking nasty it was.
Oh God, yeah.
I don't believe in that binary division of good and evil, or rather I didn't. And now I kind of do.
Oh,
sorry.
It was shocking. I mean, we're taking Alberto on quite the journey through British culture here.
He loves it.
Yeah, indeed. I loved it. Yeah. I loved it.
Oh crap. I've got to go to my house inspection. Chaps, thanks for joining us. We should have probably talked more about the software, but everybody gets the gist, I think.
Well, organize
it now. Nice to be with you, John.
Sweet. But remember, Cobra Kai matters.
Before the next podcast, I'll be an aficionado.
Bring it. And Fintan is back for our third guest. I don't know. I don't think he didn't like the second guest, but he certainly was not here. And he's made his way back because it's ladies' night. Fintan, I'd like you to greet Sharon Singleton and Roz Wade from AG Brief. Sharon, Roz, welcome.
Thank you.
We're very pleased to have you back, and thank you for returning again. It's really, really kind. Quick plug before we actually talk about the stuff that we want to talk about. Well, I mean, not that we don't want to talk about it, we do want to talk about it. But you've got an event coming up, haven't you?
That's right. We have finally our fourth edition of the ASEAN Gaming Summit in Manila.
Carry on, Russ.
He really doesn't like that summit. Oh my goodness. Oh, it was the phone call. Okay, sorry.
Yes, we have the ASEAN Gaming Summit, which will be held in Manila again, the fourth edition since we've missed a couple of years. And that's going to be on 25th to 27th of July.
Fantastic. And who's going to be there?
All things both land-based and online gaming, sports betting. In the ASEAN region.
Sweet. That call that just came in, by the way, that was one of those recorded phishing scams.
Nice.
So it wasn't even an interesting call. At least when I was doing the interview earlier on, the call that came in was, you know, the lady that was coming to do my house inspection. But this one was just, this is a call from Bank Security Department. Yeah, of course it is. So, also, though, you guys have a podcast, don't you?
We have podcasts regularly, and we also do video interviews every Friday, which is one of our other featured slots, if you like, featured content. Yeah.
So video, that's quite exciting. I mean, we don't use video deliberately because
too sexy.
Because of what we look like.
Yeah, too so, sexy.
That's it, Fintan. Too sexy. But that doesn't mean that you guys aren't. Oh fuck! This is a you've oh, no. opened up a oh, can no. of worms.
What have I done?
Let's roll that one back. Let's not go there.
I thought I was making fun of me and John. That was completely mistimed. I'm sorry.
Horribly wrong.
I know, because now if I start complimenting your appearance, that's worse. And now I'm just in this. Let's just pretend that never. Let's just start again.
Let's stop digging.
So tell me about this conference.
So but we've asked you guys to come back again because Asia's quite exciting at the moment, and the A in AG Brief stands for Asian, so like, you know, we thought you'd be good to talk. Philippines is, it seems to be in the headlines every other day at the moment. Well, depending on what you're reading, if you're reading the Asian stuff, then it's probably every day. But what's going on in the Philippines? Because there's been some big stuff happening.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, obviously the very latest news is new president Bongbong Marcos, which is, you know, huge news for the country as a whole. And presumably for gaming, although we don't quite know yet what the impact on gaming is going to be. Or what his policies are going to be.
Well, that's a little bit scary.
It is a bit. I mean, on the whole, people seem to think that he's quite business friendly. So during his campaign, he hasn't really raised any red flags as towards, you know, coming in like Duterte did and banning gambling left, right, and center and declaring war on the industry. So I don't think that's likely to happen. But, you know, there will be changes for sure.
I think I think what's interesting is that, yes, I agree with Sharon, is that, you know, on the whole, he's perceived as being very business friendly, talking about massive infrastructure development plans. And certainly, you know, the people I've garnered opinion from so far seem to think that he's, you know, good for them, good for business. I suppose there are some reservations about, one, you know, the fact that he's a Marcos, for one. There'll be a lot of, you know, speculation about relationships with China. And, of course, that's really, you know, what a lot hangs on is particularly with the online gaming and also, of course, land-based gaming, the casinos, is, you know, how strong is he going to be at deflecting China's desires to prevent their citizens gambling, whether that be online or in casinos? And Duterte had a pretty strong man attitude towards that. But, you know, then you've got South China Seas and all kinds of things added into the mix.
Yeah, I think we should also point out here for your viewers, not viewers, because we just decided we can't actually see us, but is that with the incoming administration, what you also get is a complete change of management with the Philippine Amusement and Gaming Corporation, which is a regulator. So not just a new chairman, but pretty much the entire board gets replaced. And there is always concern that that incoming administration is going to want to put their stamp, their imprimatur on the industry and probably make some kind of changes. We don't know anything at the moment about the proposed structure of PAGCOR or who might be a candidate put forward to that particular position, which is considered as sort of a real plum position in the country.
With the incoming dude being, as I believe Roz pointed out just now, a Marcos, and I hate to be anything other than predictable, but would now be a good time to invest in the Philippine shoe industry?
Wow. I expect Yes, global shoe industry, perhaps, John.
Maybe, yeah, yeah.
But also the art industry. Also the art industry. Did you not see what happened?
I did.
It was the photo.
Yes.
And like the missing Picasso just casually up on the wall.
Brilliant. Yeah, I don't expect it's quite very well climate controlled there either to protect the Picasso. Just imagine it's probably decaying in the Philippines humidity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the story, the background story is that apparently they seized this, you know, one of these Picassos, I don't know which one, several years ago, and it's supposedly being held, you know, by the government in some secure location. And then, hey presto, it pops up in Marcos's, his mother's, you know, Melda Marcos's mansion on the wall. so which one is the fake? Somebody's got a fake.
I mean, most people's memory of the Marcos regime internationally, I mean, we laugh about it fundamentally. I mean, is the incoming guy got, is this an obstacle he's got to overcome, or is he being greeted with huge optimism?
Well, this is the interesting thing. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. I read an article about actually how this could be the end of the Philippines, you know. I think it was a New York Times article written by a Filipino. And this is the worry, is that people are laughing at them for, you know, the choices they make, I suppose. And you know, maybe counterintuitively, the vast majority of the young population do support what they call a strong president, and seem to have forgotten, you know, what happened, I guess, however many 40 years ago, 30, 40 years ago. But that is a real issue, is that there's been an enormous amount, or there are accusations of an enormous amount of historical whitewashing going on. So sort of recasting his whole presidency again as one of golden era of industrial and economic development, ignoring the fact they're still paying off debt from his administration, you know, missing gold, all this sort of thing. I mean, also the fact that both he and his mother have been convicted of corruption and he of tax evasion, and yet somehow completely reinstalled pristine, squeaky clean again.
Because if I'm not wrong, Roz, shouldn't that have precluded him from even running for office?
One would think. But, you know, again, they've got their tentacles so far into the judiciary system. He's already said that, you know, he's going to protect Duterte from any kind of international corruption investigation for his war on drugs. So, you know, from the outside, it certainly looks like an awful lot of cronyism. But, but hey, you know, maybe we're wrong, and maybe he will be, you know, what the Philippines needs.
Yeah. You say that, but I've just been reading about this fellow who we shall call Bongbong. And there is an urban legend about him, which I've only just read, but I'm inclined to believe. Wikipedia is an unimpeachable source of facts. Between the late 70s and early 80s, an urban legend became popular claiming that Marcos Jr. I'm not laughing at the next bit. Sorry, I'm laughing at the bit after that. Was stabbed and died during a scuffle while studying abroad. The Marcos family allegedly looked for Bongbong's lookalike to replace him.
It's more and more and more bizarre.
He's apparently debunked it in a video blog, but you know, he would say that.
I must admit, I have never ever heard that particular anecdote. Thank you.
Breaking news.
And who would be able to say?
I wouldn't mind a byline if you guys wouldn't, you know, I need to spread my wings. But there was alleged cocaine usage as well.
Well, I think even Duterte characterized him as a, you know, no good druggie.
Well, you know, I've known a lot of drug users, and most of them were very capable people.
Got a bit more energy than the most.
Exactly. Sometimes they need a nap, but, you know, it's fair enough. But also in Asia, there has been, there is potentially exciting news coming out of Macau, but it's multi-layered. What's going on down there?
Oh, it's very multi-layered, John. I know you're referring to that sort of little carrot that they dangled the other day about a potential tax cut for the operators if they could diversify the tourism base and bring in foreigners from overseas. There is absolutely no detail as yet as to how this proposal will work. And it's also could be a varying tax rate for each individual operator, depending on how successful they are. But on the flip side of that, it is also, when they announced it, there was also the tacit acknowledgement that China is targeting people increasingly who are going overseas to gamble. And whereas at first that was thought to exclude Macau, more and more there's a realization that that does not exclude Macau. Macau is also in that. There are reports now of increased scrutiny of business travelers coming into Macau and a clampdown of anybody coming more than three times a year to gamble. So could have a very significant impact on the GGR and has sent them scrabbling around looking for alternatives. But I could give you a few figures here if you wanted to that somebody's just passed to me. But prior to the pandemic, when the borders were in fact open, basically foreigners from outside Greater China only accounted for 8% of visitation to Macau. Mm-hmm. Their budget on average was a third of that of the Chinese visitors, and they also play low yielding games. And on top of that, their real contribution to GGR is probably around 2-3% of the total. So yeah, that's a big ask.
Yeah.
And I suppose it goes back, Sharon, doesn't it, to the whole blacklist question and whether Macau is or is not on this, you know, spurious or this blacklist that China's mentioned before.
Well, I think that's now been, you know, the hood has been lifted now, the blinkers are off, and people have realised that, yes, it does include Macau, very much so.
And did I read that they've stopped how many? 91,000 potential gamblers from travelling abroad?
Yes, that was since 2021. 900,000 people have been stopped. And wow, they were suspected to have been going overseas for gambling purposes, and they were encouraged not to go. But on top of that, there were also, I can't remember the exact figures, but more than 10,000 prosecutions relating to people who were actually organizing gambling trips or enticing people overseas to gamble. And if you remember rightly, this became a criminal offense last year, mm-hmm. that is now punishable up to 10 years in prison if you are caught trying to lure Chinese into casinos overseas.
Well, yeah, because they hate that. But this is a little complicated for me. Because you got this kind of, they want fewer people to go abroad to gamble. They're counting Macau as being abroad, which is slightly peculiar given all the integration, etc. Mm. They're then saying, hey, lads, operators, you know, we might bring your tax rate down if you play ball with this, that, and the other. So the Macanese government is going to get less tax from less revenue anyway. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, it's really peculiar.
Raises more questions than it actually answers. I mean, it smacks of desperation in some ways.
But it smacks of two or three different people being desperate and not talking to each other.
Exactly. Exactly. But I think, you know, they've just basically gone after the China market, the low-hanging fruit, for years and years and years. They were told to diversify their economy. They were told to diversify their tourism base. You keep hearing these pretty campaigns about creating a world center of leisure and tourism in Macau, but nothing actually concrete ever happens. And I know you've been to Macau several times, and, you know, it caters for the mainland Chinese. There's no two ways about it. English is really very poorly spoken. And just the general catering and everything is tailored at the mainlanders.
When I first started going there, which is when G2E Asia was still in the Space Needle thing, you were just, you know, well, like, you know, one executive in the gambling industry is probably about 6 feet tall and blonde. And whenever you saw her, she would have families of Chinese people following her because you didn't see Westerners, you didn't see 6 foot tall women, and you didn't see blondes.
Yeah.
And that's not the case now. It's a much more international visitation. There's definitely many more Australians going, more people from other parts of Asia, loads more Indians, absolutely stacks more Indians. But it's still a tiny percentage.
Yeah, exactly. Coming off a tiny, tiny base. And I think the last 2 years have really set back Macau. Obviously, they've had the border shut. If you are not from Greater China, you couldn't enter Macau, even if you are prepared to go through there. I think it's still 21-day quarantine for most places. They may have cut that back to 14, but it's still a lengthy, lengthy quarantine period just to go to Macau. And in that space of time, you know, there are other jurisdictions around Asia which are coming up very strongly. Obviously, the Philippines being one of them, got some properties springing up in Vietnam. Singapore is expanding. You have a major new expansion in Malaysia. All of these places, frankly, have got an interesting offering and probably are a lot more cheap, a lot more value for money. Mm. So...
Did you say 900,000 people have been stopped?
Yes.
Wow. That's a lot of people. That's like almost four Norwiches.
Hang on a minute. Sorry, 900,000. Am I thinking 90,000?
I think it might be 90,000.
90,000 is a figure.
Still, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, that's a third of a Norwich. I mean, I use Norwich as my scale. If it's an image, then I use a banana. But if it's just speaking figures, I use Norwich.
Because most people know Norwich.
Exactly.
Really well.
Exactly. And, you know, somebody's like, oh, New York's got 8 million people in it. I think, how many Norwiches is that? That's probably hang on, just bear with me a second. 32 Norwiches.
In New York,
I mean, ish. If it does have 8 million people,
they might wish they were in New York. Those Norwiches.
No, I like Norwich more. It's a great town, and it's deeply undervalued by the likes of you, Ross.
Obviously,
I take it all back. I can't speak from experience, so I take it all back.
I lived there twice, and I'm a big fan. Big fan. And it's a town, it's a city that makes even South Shropshire look bustling. It's extraordinary. So is it, well, anything else happening anywhere else in Asia, or is it all quiet? It's probably pretty quiet.
Well, Singapore,
Karen. Singapore apparently is coming back. You know, we had the Las Vegas Sands CEO on the first quarter conference call saying quite clearly, Singapore is back. They've seen incredible pent-up demand. It's been one of the first places in Asia to completely reopen its borders. And there is quite considerable optimism about the recovery prospects this year and next. Although beyond that, the picture does get a bit cloudier due to this whole lack of China gambler. Because even when the Chinese can travel again, they, you know, they're probably not going to get that top up from the Chinese VIP market. Mm-hmm. And then obviously we've got, I'm just realizing where that 900,000 figure has come. I was writing something earlier today about the Star Entertainment case, which is lumbering along in Australia with all its embarrassing implications still. And that's starting to claim heads of the various boards, members and senior managers now, as that goes on. The 900,000, of course, being referring to the amount of money that was put on China UnionPay cards and attempted to be passed off as hotel or travel expenses, when in fact it was going into the casino. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm just glad that that hasn't gone away yet, because it's the one thing that us in the Northern Hemisphere often associate Australia with is soap operas, and this one is just going to run and run, I think.
It's a classic. I mean, really, it's just been, you know, the executives who've all been on the stand, and it's sort of very different from the Crown Resorts trial, which seemed a lot more, I don't know, they seemed a bit more supportive of each other. Here at Star, they all seem to have thrown each other under the bus. Some fingers pointing and, oh, no, blame this one, blame that one. It's been quite extraordinary, actually.
Well, that makes it more interesting and amusing for us. I mean,
soap operas, yeah.
Nobody's watching the Johnny Depp case because everybody's coming out of it well.
Exactly.
Luckily, I've got the mother of our offspring, Fern. She keeps me up to date on what's going on in the Johnny Depp trial because, I don't want to watch
it. Let's not go there.
No. Well, you've also got the Wagatha Christie trial in the UK.
Yeah, I have not. Yeah. I have seen the headlines. I have not clicked on a single one of them. I cannot bear to bring myself to even deign that with a second of my attention.
What a brilliant name.
Like, summarize for us, Vinton, so we don't have to read it.
To be honest with you, I don't have a clue. So I'm just blown away by the Wagatha Christie title.
It's beautiful. Whoever thought of that needs promoting.
But then somebody's added on to it, so it's the Wagatha Christie Scouse Trap. So for the non-UK listeners, it's basically two footballers' wives. One of them was allegedly leaking Instagram stories of the other. She was leaking stories to the Sun or one of the newspapers.
It was the Sun, yeah.
And then the leaky, or basically there was an Instagram trap set where certain information was shared with her only, and they kind of narrowed down who it was. And now there's phones have been thrown off boats, and PR people are too sick to attend trial, and it's a whole shenanigans of stuff. But yeah, it's just Wagatha Christie's Scouse Trap is just fantastic.
But to explain where Wagatha comes from, it's a collective noun, wag. It's a collective noun for wives and girlfriends. And it was initially applied to, I think it was 2002 World Cup was the first time it really appeared in the media. Because the wives and girlfriends were banned from the England training camp, and so, you know, it was used a lot in the press. So I guess they just got bored of pressing Control C, Control V. So made a catchy term. But yeah, it's Jamie Vardy's wife and Wayne Rooney's wife. But interestingly, my favorite thing about this story is that when Rebecca Vardy was on the stand, and I might be remembering this incorrectly. I hope not, because I'll probably get sued.
Thinking of publicity. Let's get sued. Be brilliant.
Sorry. Get on it. When she was on the stand, one of the questions she was asked was about a story that she had allegedly leaked about another footballer, a guy called Danny Drinkwater, who used to play for Leicester City and went to Chelsea. And basically, she did leak that story to the Sun. And in her defense, she was like, oh, yeah, I leaked that story, but I didn't leak any of these other ones.
What a world.
Like the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard case, are you just looking at this and thinking, the only winners in this are the lawyers? The amount of money that is being pumped through them is just obscene. Yeah, there are other things that could be spent on, which could go quite far. You know, instead of suing each other, go and spend it on a fucking food bank.
Yeah.
See, I wonder. So we're looking at this from outsiders. We're not in the football world, you know, just shaking our heads going, oh, my God, those people.
Speak for yourself, Ross.
But yes, I'm not in the world of football. I wonder how all of this Crown and Star stuff, you know, plays out to the non-gaming industry. You know, that's always been a major issue, is is public perception, and it, you know, none of it looks good, does it?
Do you know how I think that looks to the wider public? I think they look at it and go, oh yeah, bloody typical.
Exactly.
I knew they were doing that, etc., etc., and we just perpetuate the stereotype. Every day we get a chance to do things differently. Every day we get a chance to start afresh. And all too often, too many people in the industry are just doing the same shit again and again, and you see the same fines for the same things on the same company. And, you know, you just think,
don't touch themselves.
You know, at some point, somebody's going to think, hey, if I invest this money and I train people and I change this model in this little way, we won't get fined. And it might cost me £1 million to do that, but I won't get fined 10 million.
Well, yeah, that's not return. Unfortunately, what happens is the fines, you know, are not significant enough to, you know, to prevent that kind of behavior, because they're making so much more from illegal or suspicious means, suspect means.
Yeah, exactly. I agree, Ros. I think that's exactly what the deal is. It's just too much money sloshing around in the grey markets when it comes to the online gambling industry that, you know, why would you stop? Fine is a drop in the bucket.
Mm. Yeah, I don't mean to sound depressed, but I am a little bit.
That did sound depressed. But speaking of which, Sharon, maybe you can, because I mean, I've read it too, but the latest ARF report, you know, about that, what they found about, you know, legal versus illegal online gambling sites.
Yeah.
Quite interesting.
Yes, it is quite interesting. The report's not actually been officially released as yet, but yes, they've done a major new study looking at over 500 gambling sites and found that the vast majority of them, I think it was about 60%, are technically operating illegally, because they point out, you know, quite rightly that just because you have a license from Malta doesn't make it legal for you to go and then accept bets from Malaysia or China or anywhere else where it's actually illegal at the point of sale. And it just points out this incredible sort of confusion that this creates, where, you know, members of the public actually think, oh yeah, this is a licensed regulated company, it's all okay. Well, it's not technically. So yeah, it's very interesting.
That is...
There are like three categories, essentially. So there's the licensed casinos who operate in legal markets where they're allowed to. Then there's licensed, you know, operators who, for example, Malta, but also the Philippines, and I think the other one mentioned was Curacao, you know, have a license there, but marketing to and accepting bets from China, for example, you know, where clearly it is illegal. And then there's the straight out and out black illegal ones that haven't got a license anywhere.
And just curious about when that money comes into those businesses. Well, all right, so say you're a land-based company, say you're MGM, right?
Yeah.
And when MGM was looking to do was it Boston Harbor? Can't remember. But where they were going to break ground like 7 or 8 years ago. And they had investigations into the company for licensing purposes. And they said, no, you've got a business deal with Pansy Ho in Macau. You can't do this because she might be dodgy, right?
Yeah.
So you've got all these companies that are licensed in various jurisdictions, and they're, in theory, heavily regulated and monitored for those licenses. Surely the accounting of their income has an impact on that licensing. So at some point they have to say, look, we earned all this money from abroad. Where's it from? Do you see where I'm going with this?
Sort of, but they are obviously legally... Well, we've just been talking about how it... No, I mean, they are legally allowed to accept bets in Macau, so that's okay.
Right.
It doesn't matter. If you're Malaysian, for example, you can go to Macau and the casino is, you know, is not doing anything wrong by allowing you to play in their casino. I think it's slightly different for online casinos because, you know, then there's a whole cross-border.
Sorry, aspect. Yeah, I am talking about online casinos. I was just using that licensing example for MGM.
So, it's a good. So, just to jump in here is the online nerd. So, the land-based guys, like, are 100% compliant, 100% of the time. Obviously, you know, the crowd. We've talked about the crowd and stuff, but like compared to the online guys, you know, where the nature of great, like, if you look at any publicly listed online operator, their report has regulated markets, and basically they either call it gray or unregulated markets, or soon to be regulated, or some sort of thing like that. And it's very much an issue there. I think going back to the question is, I think the reason they can get away with it is that every regulator is only worried about their country. So if you're the regulator for Malta, you're really only worried about protecting, you know, are they playing by the local rules, which says you can operate abroad, give or take, or if you're Curaçao or somewhere like that, or then even if you're the UK regulator, you're really worried about how these operators, because it'll be the regulators with more teeth, like the US regulators or the UK or maybe even Sweden or somewhere, or Germany, where if they start looking, how are you conducting your business in the rest of the world? That's the only time you're going to get that clamped down.
Yeah, but surely this comes under AML.
Well, I mean, even the UK regulator or Malta doesn't allow you to take money from Iran, for example, and yet they're, you know,
yeah, those dodgy revenue bastards. From Iran,
you know, and extrapolate that to. So does that mean if you're Malta that and you are an operator and you somehow, you know, are reporting revenue from Greater China, for example, which does happen? This is what I don't understand is, you know, there is revenue coming from these illegal territories, illegal as Sharon says, at point of sale. So how are they reporting that revenue?
As Fintan said, I saw it recently in a company, which a UK listed company, and it calls them grey markets. But I mean,
I just thought that meant older players.
So the three classifications. So white is regulated and we're licensed. Black is, it's clearly not allowed. Like, so the legislation clearly bans it. So Singapore, for example, would be, online Singapore would be considered black market, or online casino in Australia is black market, or online casino or sports book outside of the regulated states in the US, for example. And then gray market is this lovely legal thing where concept of where there is no clear legislation for the online gambling piece. And that's where they're, you know, that's where the industry's historically made its money. Because the industry, it's a bit like all the crypto stuff right now. You can't move for like crypto.com and FTX and advertising everywhere because they've moved so fast and so far ahead of the legislation hasn't caught up yet. And that was the gambling industry forever, or the online gambling industry since the internet. And now they're in this really messy transition into, you know, you're either white or black, and you kind of got to make, and the gray is disappearing very quickly.
Well, unfortunately, there's an awful lot of money sloshing around in those gray and black markets.
Oh, 100%. So. Yeah. They're huge. It's still the majority of the world, right? It's still the majority of the world is gray or black. Mm.
Well, I believe we'll be discussing that on a forthcoming episode of the Gambling Files podcast.
We do. We've got a special guest next week who's going to tell us all about it. A lovely segue.
Thanks. On that note, Sharon Singleton, Roz Wade, thank you so much for joining us again and making this another spectacular episode of The Gambling Files.
Thank you, John.
Thank you,
Fintan.
Thanks, guys.
Nice to speak to you again.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Gambling Files, please find and follow us on Twitter under the handle @GamblingFiles. Find our podcast page on LinkedIn, which is The Gambling Files Podcast. Go along to the website and sign up, subscribe, etc., which is www.thegamblingfiles.com. Please tell your friends, tell your colleagues, tell anybody that might be interested because, you know, it's fun. That's it, really. See you next time.